Good afternoon. I'm Philip Martin, sitting in for Callie, and this is the Callie Crosley Show. Today we ask, what exactly is the Tea Party movement, and who is represented in this open tent of conservative discontents? Now, the New York Times described one of its founders, a young woman from Seattle, as someone with a pierced nose who performs improv on weekends. She and others are seen as part of a mainstream grassroots uprising. But some also fear that the Tea Party is attracting extremists to its ranks. One person identified with the movement showed up at a healthcare rally in New Hampshire hosted by President Obama with a gun strapped to his thigh. However it is perceived, the Tea Party movement is a force to be reckoned with, as all our guests today seem to agree. Now, we're joined by David Wego. He's a senior reporter for the Washington Independent. In the studio with me right now, we have Chip Burleigh, senior analyst with Political Research Associates in Somerville, Massachusetts. And from Montgomery, Alabama, Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has just come out with a special issue on this very, of their magazine on this very issue, the Tea Party movement and the right wing in the United States. Now, what do you think about the Tea Party? Are you a member? Will you sign up? We're at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Now, turning to our guests, gentlemen, all of you have done research on the Tea Party movement. Let's delve into it. Let's begin with David Wego, who's written several articles on the movement for the Washington Independent, including one, David, where you profiled a man named Dale Robertson of Houston. This guy held up a sign at one rally that is now popularly associated with the Tea Party. Briefly, tell us about it and what it says in your view about the citizens' backlash to the Obama administration.
Well, Dale Robertson's sign, which I think is easy enough to find if you Google the poor guy, compared the status of taxpayers under Barack Obama to the status of people given the N-word insult. And he was frog-marched out of his local Tea Parties. He's basically persona non grata within the people who appear on television and speak for the movement, but he's still organizing these events. And that's the thing. It's so inchoate and so randomized that anyone who says they're a Tea Party activist now can start a rally, get credibility, and that includes people who are, I think, like the woman you're talking about, Seattle, pretty normal, people who are fairly extreme, and then I think the biggest number of people who are just basically Republican activists who've decided this is a better way to sell their ideas than with the elephant logo.
Okay, David, first of all, let me correct your name. I should have said Wego, correct?
Yes, that's
okay,
fine.
Okay, well, let's put that on the record. Turning now to Mark Potok in Montgomery, the Southern Poverty Law Center has just published a special issue of its intelligence report called Rage on the Right. You're known for investigating Klansmen, Nazis, organizations of that sort. What's the connection here, and how does that reflect on what you just heard from David?
Well, what we do is at the end of every year, we publish essentially a look-back essay along with counts that we do of various kinds. The main count we've done for years are of quote-unquote hate groups, that is essentially race-based type groups, neo-Nazi groups, Klan groups, and so on. This year, though, we had noticed earlier in the year a really remarkable resurgence of the so-called patriot groups, which included militias that were so active back in the 1990s. In addition, we saw a very large growth in the number of what we term internally, anyway, nativist extremist groups, hardline anti-immigration groups like the Minutemen, Citizens Border Patrol groups, and so on. So, you know, what we found overall was there was an astounding growth in the number of these groups over the last 12, maybe 18 months, particularly in the world of militias and patriot groups, but also in the nativist groups, and the hate groups are very high as well. So, you know, how all that relates to this conversation is that, you know, we said in the essay that, look, you get, as David, I think, really suggested in his remarks just now, you can't describe the Tea Parties uniformly, I think, as extremist groups or as radical right-wing groups, but I do think that it's fair to say they're fairly shot through with many of the ideas you see elsewhere. You know, that's not always racism. Oftentimes it's ideas like the conspiracy theories, essentially, that come right out of places like the Patriot Movement. So, you know, the idea that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, for instance, is secretly running or building an array of concentration camps into which they plan to throw good patriotic Americans who resist the so-called New World Order. That idea is now very much present among many of the people in the Tea Party world. So essentially what I'm describing is a situation where these groups generally on the right are growing very rapidly. There's a real, as Chip has written, a real populist rebellion going on now. And we're seeing a great deal of cross-pollination of the ideas of the various sectors of the radical right.
In other words, a very complex movement. And as I mentioned, it's an open tent, but it's also a very large tent.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying that when you look at the Tea Parties, you know, there are what could be identified as some left-wing populist streaks, you know, particularly rage and justifiable rage, it seems to me, directed at the bankers who get, you know, multimillion-dollar bonuses while the rest of us, people who are really struggling, get nothing.
One of the things I noticed over the weekend was an article in the New York Times on Sunday which talked about the efforts to separate the Tea Party's principal complaint about bankers and about the economy and about fiscal responsibility, trying to separate that from social themes that have largely been prevalent on the Republican Party's agenda over the years, particularly religious organizations. Now, Chip, you have written several articles about the Tea Party, including its connections to religious movements. Can you elaborate, and how does that, and again, how does, what's the connection there?
Well, it comes from several dimensions, because what we're seeing is a populist movement which historically has moved either left or right, and that there's a current contention for these varied forces to try and make it coherent. And you're seeing that both from the right wing of the Republican Party. You're seeing that from organized white supremacist groups. They're pulling at either side of the movement. But within the movement, there are different groups of people with religious views about poverty, about race, about gay rights. And there's a battle going on within that that reflects the larger battle within Protestantism and evangelicalism between people who look at poverty and see, you know, the need to for the government to step in and fix, you know, some of these problems, and the people who see the government stepping in as undermining God and country.
Well, what it seems to suggest to me, gentlemen, is that you have a massive tension that's going on here. And part of that tension is comes with the redefinition of what is mainstream. I think when you're hearing from individuals like Glenn Beck, for example, on Fox News, who's exhorting his followers to, if you will, rebel against the Obama administration's policies, I guess that rebellion manifests in various ways between what one might call fringe and then what one might call mainstream. David Weigel, can you talk about that a bit? Obviously, there are some tensions going on here, and how are they resolving it within the Tea Party movement?
Well, I think Mark and Chip are right that things that used to be more on the fringe, if we want to use that word, things that didn't used to rise to the top of Republican politics are being transmitted in the Tea Parties. The tension, I think, is a bit overrated. I mean, everyone who is who's been working in the conservative movement writ large has basically jumped on this bandwagon and seen that there's a pool of conservatively hundreds of thousands of people who are activists who might not have been activists a year ago, and they can use that. I think some social conservative groups have lost a little bit of face, but by and large, I read a lot of the direct mail they send out. I read a lot of the email appeals they send out, and people like Gary Bauer, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, they've totally embraced the idea that of the Tea Party movement. They just want to emphasize abortion as a reason to vote against health care instead of the creeping socialism. I mean, that's a bit separate, too, just from, you know, the very strange ideas about the way America works or the way the world economy works that have become more and more popular, more ingrained because this movement's been growing. I mean, almost guys like Tony Perkins are trying to drag it to toward a politics that we recognize, whereas the Tea Party itself have been driving further to the right.
Let me also mention at this point that we had someone from the Tea Party who was going to join us today. Unfortunately, she's not able to do that. But I wanted to folks out there to know that we have invited and had invited a member of the Tea Party to join us. The latest issue of The Economist has an article called Angry White Men, in which they cite racism as being a large part of the movement. But not the only part. They said racism does not explain, for example, how Barack Obama's administration lost about 20 to 30% of its support among white voters. What role does race play in this conversation about the Tea Party movement, Mark Potok?
Well, I felt that perhaps I'm in a minority on this one, but I felt that when Jimmy Carter said behind all of what we're seeing stands race, there was a lot of truth. I mean, I think you can't say that it was definitively behind everything stands race, but I think the background of all of this, quite apart from real things that the Obama administration has done or not done, is the fact that this country is changing, and changing fairly dramatically in demographic terms as well as in economic terms, in terms of globalizing and so on. The idea, as predicted by the Census Bureau, that whites will lose their majority in 2050, certainly among the people I normally cover, the real radical right, that fact is imprinted on each of their frontal lobes, very deeply. They worry and fret, and so I see behind this, as well as behind the real backlash we saw in the year or so after Obama was elected, and some portions of the white population, a real rage and frustration about the way the country's changing. I mean, look, down here in Alabama, there are whole cities that have changed quite dramatically, cities that are used to essentially being made up of black and white people. I mean, that's race in the South, or it was until recently. And now some of those places are 40% Hispanic. So I'm just suggesting there are real changes out there. And for some people, I think a great many people, there's this kind of underlying feeling of, not only is the economy gone to hell, not only has this or that happened, but the country I grew up in, the country my Christian white forefathers created, as they have it in their minds, has somehow been stolen. So I think that is present.
Well, let's talk about the political implications when we're back. I'm Philip Martin, sitting in for Kelly Crosley, and we're taking a close look at the Tea Party movement. What's your view of this fledgling organization? Give us a call. We're at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting vocal savant Bobby McFerrin, Sunday, March 21st, 3 p.m. at Symphony Hall. For tickets and information, you can visit celebrityseries.org. That's celebrityseries.org. And from Newbury Court, overlooking the Sudbury River in Concord, Mass., a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. You can learn more at newburycourt.org, a Deaconess Abundant Life community. And from Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store where you'll find a variety of dinner options, including marinated meats, heat-and-eat sides, and stir-fries, all with flavors inspired from around the globe. Locations at TraderJoe's.com.
On Monday, March 22nd, watch academic teams from across Massachusetts go head-to-head on the new high school quiz show.
What is the capital of Brazil? Anyeza.
Brasilia.
Yes, they have the molecule that carries genetic information in all living organisms. Anyeza.
DNA?
Yes.
I'm Daya Lakshmi Narayanan. Tune in starting Monday, March 22nd at 7:30 on GBH2 for High School Quiz Show.
Right now on 89.7, we're not interrupting any of your favorite programs with this.
Whether you give $5, $10, $20, $100.
Instead, we're playing more of this.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered.
Thanks to WGBH sustainers, listeners who make ongoing contributions of $5, $8, or $9 a month, WGBH can spend less time fundraising and more time reporting. Help 89.7 reduce pledge by becoming a sustainer right now, securely, online at WGBH.org.
We'll be right back.
I'm Philip Martin, and this is the Callie Crosley Show. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Tea Party movement with Chip Berlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates in Somerville, Massachusetts, Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and David Weigel, senior reporter for the Washington Independent. How do you view the Tea Party movement? Can it change the face of politics in Massachusetts and elsewhere? We're at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Speaking of Massachusetts, now, our newest senator, as everyone knows by now, is Republican Scott Brown. David Weigel, how much credit should be given to the Tea Party movement for Brown's upset victory over Attorney General Martha Coakley?
A little bit less than I think is usually given. Tea Party groups had two roles in this. One was that local conservative activists got involved early on and gave him the ballast to do more campaigning than Republican candidates can usually do in Massachusetts. But once it was the real gasoline in the tank came from Mitt Romney's donors and a lot of financial people who decided this was worth at least investing in as a speculation in case he could do something amazing. Only when he really surged in the polls did the Tea Party groups that are more aligned with the Republican Party get involved in this, like the Tea Party Express. It's a group run by Republican consultants. So they eventually took credit for it. But it was really the small-scale conservative activists who started off. And that's the tension I always see. There are people who are real angry Americans, and then there are more people who are Republican activists in different clothing.
Well, they might not have done they might not be given as much credit for Scott Brown's victory, but they tend to think they can turn elections around in a number of other states, for example, Arizona, where John McCain apparently is in the fight for his life. How does that look?
Well, the first polls in the race that encouraged J.D. Hayworth, who's a former congressman, served from the 94 election to the 2006 election, got into it. They showed Hayworth doing about tied with McCain. He's been slipping since then. And McCain has endeavored pretty hard to win over these Republican groups that are credible with Tea Partiers but are not themselves Tea Party groups. He's built something of a lead. He's doing so, though, and this is something that's been happening all year. It's not so much that Tea Parties exist. It's that they're convincing members of Congress that to survive, they should move to the right. And they're doing that with Democrats and with Republicans. McCain, who has a record more than most people in the Senate right now of crossing the aisle, has been extremely partisan Republican under Barack Obama. And having a primary challenger who's far to the right is going to make him even more so. And that's the effect. No matter what happens to the election, you're going to have a year and a half of a Democratic Congress being pushed further and further away from what it wants to do by this movement.
Now, Chip Berlay, the Tea Party movement is also hoping to score big, not just again Arizona, and as David mentioned, based on any number of issues. But there seems to be again I think there's a tension mm-hmm. between those who are talking about or heavily emphasizing deficit reduction, for example, and those who are still wedded to cultural issues around abortion and gay rights, immigration, so on and so forth. Chip, how is that playing in New England, for example, where you don't have the same emphasis on immigration and you don't have the same emphasis on abortion?
Well, we had a similar set of movements in the mid-1990s, the Patriot Movement and its armed wing, the armed militias, and they were very different geographically. And so you're right that the geographic location really sets the storyline for the various populist movements that grow. We're looking at a relatively conservative set of populist movements, so not only are we looking at deficit reduction or social issues like abortion and gay marriage, but we're also looking at immigration as a very major issue for some people in the Southwest and in the Pacific Northwest as well as parts of the South. We're looking at issues involving federal government regulation and policy. So you have all these different forces in the mix, and they're going to take on a particularity based on the state in which these tea parties are now organizing on the precinct and county level.
Now, outside of politics, I think, again, just returning to this whole grassroots movement, Mark Potok, looking at the special issue of the intelligence report. This is just out by the Southern Poverty Law Center, the spring 2010 issue. I mentioned to David early on this fellow named Dale Robertson of Houston, One of the things that struck me about Dale Robertson of Houston, a member of the Tea Party, is in addition to what you mentioned, David, is that he's a member of an organization called We the People. You profile We the People as part of the intelligence report, Rage on the Right. What is its connection to the Tea Party movement and to what Chip just mentioned in the context of militias?
Well, the Tea Party connection is much dimmer. Let me say, I mean, this is, I think, a fascinating story we ran, unbeknownst, I think, to most of the world, and certainly to us at the time. There was last May of 2009, a very important meeting held on Jekyll Island, Georgia. That's a little key off of South Georgia, a very beautiful place. It has a very fancy club on it. It was convened by the leader of We the People, a guy named Bob Schultz, who's a well-known, now over the course of 20-some years, radical tax protester, a guy who thinks that taxes are not legal and has run full-page ads in major newspapers to that effect, among other things. He brought together, I mean, talk about big tents. Schultz brought together everyone from, you know, raging anti-Semites in one case to old militia leaders, to some of the kind of iconic figures of the militia movement back in the 90s, to people from his own world, tax protesters and so on. The way they started this was in the Jekyll Island is where the Fed was conceived, where the Federal Reserve was planned out in early last century. They started their whole meeting by holding a kind of ceremony to cleanse this location of the evil thing that the Fed is in their minds. It's a part of essentially conspiracy theory. In any event, this spun out into another so-called Continental Congress, which was held last November in St. Charles, Illinois, and also hosted by We the People, much larger. And We the People has grown astronomically since then. They've got something like 1,200 delegates to the Continental Congress listed, although all of them didn't attend. Beyond that, you know, they have been essentially reaching out through some of their members to the Tea Party world. You know, a character who is very prominent in We the People, as well as a number of other organizations, is Richard Mack, and a number of other patriot organizations. Richard Mack was an Arizona sheriff who filed a very important and partly successful challenge to the Clinton administration's gun control law, the Brady Bill, and became a hero as a result. He is a member of a number of patriot organizations right now, but has been making a series of speeches to Tea Party gatherings. So, you know, that's one of the kinds of avenues that we see this sort of cross-pollination happening. You know, I've talked a little bit earlier about the, you know, some of these conspiracies, the theories that are making their way into the patriot world as a result.
I think what's fascinating about this discussion is trying to understand all these threads. How do you tie in all these threads? There's so many. And one of the things that seems clear in terms of electoral politics is that what might have been fringe in the 1990s, the militia movement, for example, what you're describing, in articles in the New York Times, in the Washington Independent, Washington Post, others, there seems to be almost a pride with these confluence of organizations coming together. No one seems to be embarrassed by the role of the John Birch Society, for example, or the role of the Patriot Movement in this backlash against the government, against the federal government. And now all of them are asking that their members go out and vote. I'm wondering what this might turn into in terms of the type of candidates we'll see in 2010 and 2012. Chip Burley?
Well, if democracy is based on informed consent, the 2010 and 2012 elections will not be around democracy. They'll be about who can construct the most elaborate and compelling conspiracy theory. And in periods like that, it doesn't bode well for the society. This came to a head in the Clinton era when the entire Clinton administration was immobilized by lurid stories about conspiracies he was alleged to have been involved in that turned out for the most part, to be completely fictitious. And the Republican Party got on board behind that, and now they're jumping back in because I think they've learned that this works. And in the short run, lurid, demagogic conspiracy theories can, in fact, mobilize large groups of people to do things that are very damaging to society.
But David Weigel, this can't be advantageous to the Republican Party, the notion of runaway conspiracy theories.
Well, we haven't seen a blowback for it yet. There might be one. They might go overboard, and we might see Republican candidates who have a good chance of winning getting subsumed by conspiracy theories. Certainly, Democratic strategists have passed out memos in D.C. saying that if you want to get an advantage over your opponent, nail him on one of these obsessions of the Tea Party movement. Nail him on whether he thinks Barack Obama was born in America or whether he thinks the 10th Amendment would nullify any health care reform that passes, things like that. But they haven't really – the only time I've seen them be hurt by this is in the special election in New York 23. A third-party candidate knocked out the Republican and lost the seat in part because he was seen as too extreme. Other than that, I mean, Republicans have been doing fine by basically indulging this movement because everything is passed off to the press pretty successfully as just understandable anger at how Barack Obama is failing America, understandable anger at health care. I don't think there's been a good job by the press done in taking this to account. I mean, I've heard members of Congress make the argument that we can nullify legislation or refuse to pay taxes or refuse to participate in a census to a stunningly high degree. And this is being treated as just weird political talk instead of the really, really sort of dangerous and offensive stuff that it is.
And that, again, brings up the question for you, Mark Potok. What does it say about the climate in the country right now when you can talk about secession, for example, in Texas and be reelected governor, and you can leave a memo around Republican committee meeting in Florida that's found by a reporter, and then we find in that memo that it talks about ways in which you can demonize the president, President Barack Obama, in ways that many would see as racialist.
I mean, to me, what it says is that the ranks of politicians and political commentators are rife with craven opportunists. I mean, you know, these are people who are willing to say almost anything, presumably to appeal to either their ratings base, if they're Glenn Beck, or their electoral base, if they're someone like Michelle Bachmann. I mean, the stuff that's being said is quite astounding, and there has been almost no effort until very recently to call these people out, certainly not by the kind of responsibles so-called of the Republican Party. I mean, so Michelle Bachmann can go out there and say that Barack Obama is building political reeducation camps, you know, presumably to turn our children into little Marxist robots. Or Spencer Baucus, a congressman from my state, Alabama, says, you know, there are 17 secret socialists in the Congress. He knows who they are, but he's not telling. The FEMA conspiracy theory being flogged by Glenn Beck, who, you know, finally on his fourth show decides it's not true after all. And on and on and on. I mean, I think that is, it seems to me, the one thing where not only people like us, but people who are normal everyday Americans doing other work can have an effect. I mean, I think that these people have to be called out. They have to be called out by their constituents. I mean, it's one thing for David and I and Chip to say these things, but, you know, we can't affect a Michelle Bachmann. It's only her constituents who can.
But David Weigel, isn't that what some members of the Tea Party are doing right now? I mean, with recent efforts, at least, to remove what are ostensibly and what are clearly, both ostensibly and clearly racist signs from marches and demonstrations. They've asked for these signs to be removed. They've asked for separation from some of the more outlandish cultural issues that have come to the fore in terms of outward propagation, propaganda rather. Is there an effort to tone things down or is there a substantive effort to remove some of these people who are extremists from their ranks?
There is, but it's been pretty cosmetic, and it is, I think, focused on things that are not that important. The Tea Party movement is, I don't think, changing American politics so that we have open discussions of Barack Obama's citizenship. It is changing American politics in that it's now up for discussion whether or not the Speaker of the House bribes people, or whether President Obama offered a judgeship to a politician's brother when, in fact, I'm going into the case of Scott Matheson, who's nominated for a post in Utah. His brother's a congressman from Utah. The judicial nominee was vetted months ago, but this has become a new conspiracy theory. I'm going into a couple of these things that just become sort of anti-government talking points and theories that really hurt the credibility and the relationship Americans have with government that are becoming more and more mainstream. And there's no effort in the Tea Parties to cramp down on that. They're really – this is dragging down the discussion we have of the way government works, and it's introducing kind of unrealistic and not factual theories of what how government is tyrannical. And I think that's the damage. I will – call someone to account when they do something obviously crazy, and so will the Tea Party people. But they might take somebody with a Hitler sign out and then later in the rally accuse Obama of being a tyrant. The Hitler sign gets noticed. The fact they accused Obama of being a tyrant is now becoming accepted. And that's happening so slowly that people aren't calling it to account.
Okay, in a word or two, maybe if you have 20 seconds, since we're wrapping up, the future of the Tea Party movement. Chip Roy?
Well, history is bad news. We've had these movements blame Freemasons and Catholics and Italian and Russian immigrants in the Palmer Raids and the McCarthy period. We've had them blame Jewish civil rights organizers for stirring up otherwise happy blacks in the South during the civil rights movement. The history of these movements is that they erode into scapegoating and conspiracy theories.
Mark Potok?
Yeah, I think very much the same thing. I mean, I point out, just to underline how bad the atmosphere is getting, when the Oklahoma City bomb went off in 1995, a few days later, a poll was run asking Americans if they viewed the government as so large and powerful that it poses an immediate threat to the rights and freedoms of citizens. 39% said yes. I thought that was astounding. A couple of Sundays ago, CNN ran exactly the same poll, and that number had reached 56% of Americans. I just think that bodes very badly for democracy.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. David, my apologies. That's all the time we have in this segment. We've been discussing the Tea Party movement with David Weigel, senior reporter for the Washington Independent, Chip Burleigh, senior analyst with Political Research Associates in Somerville, Massachusetts, and Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, local made good. Today, a different kind of musical experience.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting vocal savant Bobby McFerrin, Sunday, March 21st, 3 p.m. at Symphony Hall. For tickets and information, you can visit celebrityseries.org. That's celebrityseries.org. And from the Massachusetts Freemasons, who believe that a man's greatness can be measured, and it's not by his wealth or fame. You can learn more at the Massachusetts Freemasons website, askafreemason.org. And from Welch & Forbes, personally serving as investment advisors for New England families since 1838. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com.
On Monday, March 22nd, GBH2 launches the Ultimate Academic Challenge. Watch teams from across Massachusetts go head-to-head on High School Quiz Show. I'm Daya Lakshminarayanan. From Revere to Worcester, Ashburnham to Hyannis, teams tackle questions about history, science, current events, and more. Tune in and play along starting Monday evening, March 22nd at 7:30 on GBH2 for High School Quiz Show.
Thanks to the more than 15,000 WGBH sustainers, instead of hearing this on 89.7,
a gift in any amount is the perfect amount.
You're hearing more of this.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Because sustaining membership automatically renews, The more listeners who sign up, the less time WGBH has to fundraise on the air. If more news and less fundraising sounds good to you, then please make the switch to Sustainer securely online at WGBH.org. This is 89.7 WGBH,
Boston's NPR station for trusted voices and local conversation.
With Fresh Air and The Emily Rooney Show.
The new 89.7 WGBH.
Dream Reveals.
I'm Philip Martin, and this is The Callie Crosley Show. It's time for our regular Monday feature, Local Made Good, where we celebrate people whose creativity and individuality bring honor to New England. In today's example, we are joined by two people who have us listening in a new way. In the background, you're hearing Solemn Song for Evening, Adagio, by composer Richard Boulanger, a professor at the Berklee College of Music. We're joined now by composer Georg Haidu. He's a visiting professor at Northeastern University, and Psyche Louie. She's an instructor in neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And they're here today to discuss the Bolan-Pierce scale. It's a musical scale that offers an alternative to the octave repeating scales typical in Western music. Here's another example, very quick example. This is called BP Piscium Fragments by composer Adam Schechter, who's a student at Berklee College of Music. And perhaps you can talk about this as the music is playing in the background. If you will, Georg, what are we listening to and what's the significance?
Well, this is really an entirely different scale, different from most scales that we have encountered in music history, as it avoids the octave. It is based on a different principle, but it has shows some interesting analogies to the scales we're used to.
Well, you know, every week we're discovering something new about the brain, something new about how we respond to the various types of stimuli. Musical stimuli has always been important. Can you talk about this particular octave repeating scale, Psyche, Louie?
So musical systems around the world are usually based around the octave, right, which is a frequency ratio of 2 to 1. And all music around the world is composed that way. Different cultures divide up the octave into different numbers of steps. Some cultures use 5 steps, some cultures use 7 steps. We tend to use 12 steps.
When you say we, you're Western.
Western music, uh-huh. Yeah, including classical music and pop music. From Beethoven to Britney Spears.
From Beethoven to Britney Spears.
Or Bach to Britney Spears, I suppose. But this new scale, the Bolan-Pierce scale, is really a new musical world in the sense that it does not use the octave, as Georg mentioned. It uses a 3-to-1 frequency ratio, or a tritive, or tritive. And within that, we divide the tritive into 13 equal-tempered steps.
Go on, I'm sorry.
So the advantage of using this 13 tone division of the 3-to-1 ratio is that you get new chords that are based on 3-to-5-to-7 ratios, and well, you get other chords too. But this 3-to-5-to-7 ratio sounds relatively consonant. And since Pythagorean times, it's been proposed that these low integer ratios, when you play them together, they sound relatively smooth to the ear, and then you could use that as sort of the center of compositions. And so what I was interested in was how the brain could learn these new musical systems.
And what's the advantage of that? I mean, the brain, you're talking about adaptivity.
Right.
And so are you talking about how fast one learns, or how you is that part of what the discussion here is?
Yeah, adaptivity, flexibility, plasticity. Different people have different words for it. Right. But I was going to look at how quickly the brain can learn, first of all, how to recognize new music written in the scale, and then second of all, how to generalize, so how people can extract the underlying structure that generated the music that they just heard, which is very important for not only for music, you know, so we tend to expect certain chord progressions, you know, when something is wrong, even a non-musician will say, well, that sounds wrong, and we have some intuitive understanding of how music theory works, even without explicit instruction. But with this new Bolan-Pierce scale, because we have very little exposure to it, well, most of the world has very, very little exposure to it, you could really ask the question of how quickly these kinds of knowledge come about.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, because some would argue, though, that with a lot of this, the commonality seems to be there's an electronic background. And of course, we've had electronic music for a long time, but certainly highlighted by a group like Kraftwerk with Trans-Europe Express in Europe in the early 1980s.
Right.
And it was that became a different way of listening as well. And I'm wondering what is different now. And perhaps we could discuss this in the context of your composition, which is called This Is Beyond the Horizon. Georg, can you talk about this as we're listening to this in the background?
Yeah, absolutely. I was interested here is actually not only creating these sounds electronically. We have had electronic sounds since the 1970s, so when Heinz Bohlen, the inventor of the scale, built his first electronic organ. But I'm realizing that to create a certain mass appeal, you also have to create acoustic instruments that have the same properties of vibrating bodies. We don't necessarily like to listen to music coming out of loudspeakers all the time. Particularly when we go to concerts, we actually do prefer sometimes acoustic instruments. So it instigated the creation of clarinets. I'm using two clarinets in this piece plus an electronic instrument which has particular properties. I may talk about this a little later.
So the idea, again, is that it's a different way of learning. It's a different way of listening. But how possible is this given, you know, like we are so attuned to a Western way of producing music, and we're attuned to a Western way of listening, which a lot of that is bass inspired. Am I correct?
Both harmony, bass, melody. It's all there. Rhythm.
And here the difference is principally... Would harmony be the principal?
It's the same.
Connective.
We build new melodies, new harmonies, and if you want, we can also build new rhythms on analog ideas. So the idea is to create some sort of a parallel world. That's why I called my piece "Beyond the Horizon." You create a parallel world that functions similar to what we're used to, and that also gives us an anchor in a way, or for our minds. That makes it easy to learn the new rules.
One of the most interesting things is the collaboration between music and neurology.
Yeah.
The collaboration represented in this studio right now between the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
This is phenomenal. I mean, now, again, what do we do? Now, if someone who's listening out there wondering, you know, what does this have to do with me? What does this have to do with me, for example, in the way we inculcate information? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly. So I think one of the themes that has come out of this research and this exploration of new sounds is that the brain really is very rapidly adapting to sound streams in the environment, right? Every day we're walking around and we're listening to sounds, and we know to form expectations for sounds, right? I mean, if you hear a car coming, even if you don't see the car, you know to get out of the way. So we form these immediate expectations of what's about to happen. And, you know, there's lots of evidence showing that this is what infants use, for instance, to learn language. And so that's obviously, you know, very important to all of us. But what this research is showing is that within, let's say, the space of 20 to 30 minutes, your brain really does rapidly adapt. And that is very useful for how we learn language. So it would be interesting to see, for instance, if you had a brain lesion, let's say if you had a stroke and you have certain parts of your brain missing, whether you would still be able to learn this new musical scale just like normal undergrads would in our labs.
Oh, Georg, hi, do please.
Just to confirm what Psyche Lou was talking about, I want to quote a statement from a student who recently did a review of one of the concerts. He wrote, "As the theory behind the Bohlen-Pierce school is so different from that of even tempered tunings, it is able to convey these familiar notions, and this could be a significant benefit to the contemporary community. Maybe BP, Bohlen-Pierce, can be a gateway to other successes. Maybe it could provide the boost that this music needs to gain more widespread notoriety in the musical landscape." And that's a person that comes from a person who had no exposure to this, previous exposure to this music at all. So basically, he really understood understood the principle behind it, and it was able to see the benefits of working with such a scale.
Well, you know, for years, neurologists have tried to figure out ways to address the basically to address some of the more impenetrable aspects of this field, including how to stimulate patients, for example, who are suffering massive depression and so on and so forth, and during illness, for example. And, for example, they've turned to comedy as one way of doing that. They've turned to music as another way of doing that. Obviously, this is a different type of music, the Bowlin-Pierce scale. Mm-hmm. What's the practical impact, for example, on patients? Any idea? Who might be suffering neurological problems?
Well, we haven't done any Bowlin-Pierce scale studies on aphasics yet, but it'd be interesting to speculate. So we have some people with aphasia in our lab who, if you sing to them and if you sing with them, it turns out that after a number of sessions and an intensive singing melodic intonation therapy, they regain some of these language functions.
I see. Go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, so it could be conceivable that
you're reacting to me here in the studio, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's rapid adaptation.
Right, rapid adaptation, exactly. Uh-huh. I'm going to play something here, but this is by Anthony DeRitis, professor and chair of the music department at Northeastern University, one of your colleagues. Largely you hear the clarinet in the background. And I would like both of you to comment on this particular piece.
Well, this is a performance by Amy Advocate, who couldn't be here today. Tony DeRitis pre-recorded the samples and then assembled these clarinet sounds at home using a sequencer program.
And I'm trying to understand, and you have to forgive me on this particular piece, I'm trying to figure out how this is different from other scales that we've heard, again, in the electronic, in the area of electronic music.
Well, anything is possible in electronic music, and people have experimented with all sorts of scales. Yes, the Bowlin-Pierce scale, the first electronic instrument was built in 1972 by Heinz Bowlin, and he immediately, started composing his first pieces. What's a bit different about this is that we are actually having a number of acoustic instruments now. So Amy Advocate, Boston-based, she's an amazing clarinetist who took an immediate interest in this and actually immediately bought one of the six available clarinets that were built for this scale. And so she was she provided an enormous resource for the Boston-based composers who wrote pieces specifically for the symposium, Anthony DeRitis among them.
And I would say that one of the advantages of having acoustic instruments, I guess, for the brain in real time as we're listening to music is that there's a lack of time delay and you can really develop a causal model. You can really see during a live performance that, okay, when somebody, blows into the clarinet, it's making sounds in real life, in real time. And that's not something you could easily boast of in electronic music. I mean, people have gotten very, very good at doing real-time electronic sound manipulation. But it's still not the same kind of temporal precision and accuracy and just sort of philosophically relating to the instrument that you would get from, say, clarinet.
Of course, there are a lot of real-time jazz and classical musicians who would agree with you.
Yes.
Without question. And what? How large of a movement is this? I mean, how many people, how many musicians, composers, others are turning to this scale as a viable alternative form of music? Both musically and, I should say, in terms of research.
After the symposium, I went online. I just wanted to see what repercussions did this symposium have? And in a way, I was amazed to see that there's on Twitter and Facebook, people are starting to discuss the scale. People I've never heard of that didn't attend the symposium that have heard about it somehow through their friends and listen to examples and suddenly are the discussing the validity of the scale, and I can see it's overwhelmingly positive. It is a particular scale, and we have to talk a little bit about system theory. Maybe Psyche can also say a bit about that. There are scales that are easily internalized. So in other words, we can learn the scales easily, and the music that is being composed in the scale just makes sense. And that's what we're encountering, and that's what people are also appreciating, and that also opens up new fields of possibilities.
And is it fair to say that a good deal of this originates here in New England? Again, the idea of local made good, where, I mean, we're celebrating the fact that this particular scale, if not, did it originate here in New England?
Well, not exactly, but we have one of the proponents live in New England, Richard Boulanger, who has been working with the scale since the 1980s.
That's right.
So he is one of the key figures. The scale originated in Hamburg, Germany, and then was rediscovered in California. But, you know, Boston is halfway in between.
And given the role that Northeastern and Beth Israel and that Berkeley and other institutions have played in this, I guess it's credit that's well-deserved. That's well-deserved. We have just a few minutes. So I guess what would be the lessons here for people who are just used to listening to music in a certain type of way? If they are just used to listening to, if you will, Britney Spears or to Jay-Z or to even John Coltrane, now, what might be the lesson here?
I mean, I think we're really looking at a new Martian world, if you will. But then if you really think about it, there's nothing that scary or weird about the Martian world. There, in fact, it can be very beautiful. Kurt Rhodes, who is one of the speakers and a composer at the first day of the symposium, said that the first time he heard Roland Peirce chords, they sounded more sweet and more sour at the same time. So I think the world would be a wonderful place if we listened to more of these novel musical systems.
Okay, we're going to have a few seconds. So, Georg, how do you? What do you think?
I can quote John Cage by saying, "Happy New Year's."
It's very good. So in the background, you're hearing BP, Piscium Fragments. That's by composer Adam Schechter. My guests for this segment have been composer Georg Haidu, a visiting professor at Northeastern University, and Psyche Louis, instructor in neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Philip Martin, sitting in for Callie. You can keep on top of the Callie Crosley Show by visiting our website, wgbh.org/CallieCrosley. This is the Callie Crosley Show. Today's program was engineered by Alan Mattis and produced by Chelsea Mertz. Our production assistant is Anna White Knuckleby. We are a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.